we should be thinking about a unified approach to improving the health of civilization through interdisciplinary, multinational, collaborative efforts to develop and codify best practice guidance for the use of AI in healthcare. And I think this is the sort of thing World Health Organization is really well set up to do.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders, to government officials, to leaders of advocacy groups, academics, and others. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation. I'm very excited to have Dr. Brennan Spiegel with us today. Dr. Spiegel is the Director of Health Services Research for Cedars-Sinai, Director of the Cedars-Sinai Master's Degree Program in Health Delivery Science, and the George and Dorothy Gores Chair in Digital Health Ethics. I invited him on this show as it is very important to get different perspectives towards framing AI legislation, and we need to get the perspective of health policy leaders, especially in digital health. Welcome, Dr. Brennan. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Dr. Spiegel, can you, to our listeners, you know, who are global, they're members of Congress, staff, think tanks, CEOs, can you provide a brief overview of your work in digital health and policy and how it intersects with emerging technologies like AI?
Sure. So my focus is on research. I am a professor of medicine and public health here at Cedars-Sinai. And I'm mainly focused on understanding how to integrate technology, including artificial intelligence, with patient care and with healthcare delivery. I am not a policymaker, nor do I have training or background in policy, although I do spend a lot of time thinking about costs of care, health economics. I teach health economics in our graduate school. And, you know, I'm certainly interested in understanding how best to allocate resources around these technologies. And what's the best way to think about integrating these technologies in a way that improves our health, our quality of life, and does so in a way that doesn't cause unintended consequences?
As you said, patient care, using technology to do that, Dr. Spiegel, how do you balance potential benefits of using AI, machine learning algorithms, and other digital technologies in healthcare with concerns, let's say, for algorithmic bias, fairness, especially in the vulnerable populations, Dr. Spiegel?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a very important topic. As we all know, artificial intelligence is a reflection of us. It's a reflection of humanity. All of our experiences, knowledge, wisdom have gone into populating the models that we use. So within that comes all of our foibles too, biases, racial, ethnic, and so on. And there's extensive evidence that artificial intelligence can exacerbate biases and inequities, particularly in the delivery of healthcare, as we start to think about the application of AI in healthcare. This is an area I'm interested in for certain, and our lab is actively evaluating how to identify and mitigate bias in AI applications. For example, our lab has been recently developing a form of mental health support that uses artificial intelligence to engage with individuals. And we've recently published a paper on that. But in that instance, we've been looking to see if the system might have a bias. Does, for example, the advice that it provides vary by race or ethnicity or gender or income? And so we've actually been studying this extensively, where we have the system talk in quotes to digital standardized patients who have randomly been given different profiles, sociodemographic profiles. And then we have an objective marker to see if the tone and the type of advice it's giving varies. In this instance, we actually have not, thankfully, yet identified in the algorithm that we created evidence of bias, and we're writing up a paper, which both is to support that algorithm, but also to provide more guidance on how researchers should be thinking about evaluating for implicit bias.
That's a very important study. Dr. Brennan, if it's okay with you, I'm going to follow up on that point. The Surgeon General of the U.S. said loneliness is an epidemic in this country. Mental health is an epidemic. Now, there are a few AI apps that are targeted to loneliness being a companion. Now, some of them have got 20 million downloads, etc. And you said that bias is an inherent issue in there. Should there be some kind of a check balance? I understand you're not a regulatory expert, but something of this nature, which is, you know, 20 million people are using this.
I think that anytime we're using AI, we want to be as transparent and as rigorous as we can be. And particularly when we're working in healthcare, is unlike any other industry in the world. It behaves differently from every other industry. The currency is life years and quality adjusted life years, or qualies. It's a different type of industry and generally demands different standards. I don't know how best to answer a question in terms of that example. I think that in general, we should all be working towards evaluating formally for evidence of bias and mitigating it. And that's easier said than done. It's easy to just say, oh, thou shalt check for bias, but it's another altogether to do it and to document it and to be transparent and objective about it. So our approach is to try and model as best as we can an ideal approach to this, which is to transparently do that work and to publish our results. And it would be refreshing if other app developers, you know, did that as well.
Transparency is something that I think you're saying would be very, very helpful. So shifting from bias to maybe safety, there's an increasing popularity of, as you know, health-related apps, devices, AI tools. What steps do you think should regulators take to ensure that some of these products are meeting appropriate standards for safety, accuracy, reliability, Dr. Spiegel?
Yeah, I think for starters, anyone working in AI should follow standardized guidance, and we should come to an agreement about how to operationalize that. What are the best practices, particularly in healthcare, which is my orientation, that developers should follow? What's the checklist, if nothing, you know, think of it that way, the pre-flight checklist that developers should be held to? Now, whether this is a regulated or unregulated standard, we should all be aspiring to meet those standards. So, you know, to have a set of standards that we all follow and a set of objective ways to follow them. And it's still early, so there's a bit of a Wild West feeling to AI developers right now. To go out into the world with 20 million downloads with a system that hasn't been the subject of any peer-reviewed research, for example, or maybe hasn't been subjected to implicit bias testing, that may not be ideal. On the other hand, I don't know exactly what's ideal. I think we need to come to a consensus about that. And that may be a role for regulators, but I really feel like that's an interdisciplinary discussion. Because it's not easy. There's a lot of gray area in what one should or should not do. What is the sort of minimum standards? And then what are the aspirational standards? Like, these are not yet entirely clear cut.
Shifting from, you know, bias and safety to health equity, Dr. Spiegel, how can policymakers ensure that AI-driven health innovations are accessible and equitable for all populations? Because just like biases, health equity is also a challenge. Dr. Spiegel.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a major issue in healthcare, always has been, with advent of digital health technologies in general, and AI in particular. There's, of course, risk of only expanding and not contracting inequities if we're not thoughtful about how to implement these technologies. And of course, the reason is that, unfortunately, in this country, there are haves and there are have-nots. And there are individuals who don't have access to healthcare at all, don't have access to insurance, for example. And there tend to be sociodemographic predictors of those inequities. And so to provide some individuals with access to highly powerful technologies and not others has the risk of only expanding that. The solution is not straightforward. And again, I'm not necessarily a policy expert how to do that, but I think insurance companies do need to be a big part of this. making sure that these technologies are as accessible as possible to all of their beneficiaries. And then regulators need to think about how to keep these technologies available to Medicare and Medicaid patients, how healthcare systems can integrate them across their electronic health records for all individuals, shouldn't make any difference whatsoever what their sociodemographic backgrounds are. It's just such an evolving area right now that it's hard for me to provide a singular prescription for how to address that question, but it is a very important
one. But it's definitely a topic that you believe that regulators should pay attention to, right, Dr. Spiegel?
Absolutely. It's absolutely critical that inequities of any kind be monitored, whether it's in the implicit bias of a system, as we've talked about, or just access to these systems. Those are both very important topics in a democracy like ours.
When you work with digital health devices and also with AI, how does one protect patient data security and patient privacy? Is that a concern for you, Dr. Spiegel?
Oh, for sure. I mean, this is a critical concern. It always, whether there's AI being used or no AI being used, we have to always ensure that our informatics systems, which are now the electronic glue, so to speak, that holds a healthcare system together, abides by HIPAA standards, privacy standards, and so on. So, you know, the informatics budgets for health systems are now enormous. The electronic health record and its care and feeding is a major budget item, a major area of vulnerability, and therefore security protection for health systems. So that was all true before AI was involved. Now, when AI is involved, of course, there are other partners, other stakeholders. There are business agreements between health systems and AI providers, like, you know, Microsoft, for example, with OpenAI. And so there needs to be airtight relationships between those partners to ensure that any data that's being transmitted is HIPAA compliant and encrypted, and, you know, to the best of anyone's ability, cannot be stolen. Then you have the issue of the actual AI itself and the advice or diagnostics or whatever it's doing. How do we then ensure that it's safe in terms of its operations and its diagnoses? Now, if an AI system is making a diagnosis, that's an FDA-regulated procedure and needs to be very carefully scrutinized. What we've been doing in our own lab, for example, we've been focusing more on mental health support with AI. And there, one could imagine a risk of an AI system giving poor advice that could be unsafe. Now, so we have to test that extensively. And we even have another AI system that oversees the first AI system. In fact, we have one project where we have six AI systems working simultaneously, sort of policing one another in this networked approach to try minimize as much as we possibly can a risk of some significant misstep. There's always the risk of a black swan event, of course, and one would be naive to suggest AI can never go off the rails. But these are the sorts of things we try to do here to maximize our ability to provide safe care.
AI system supervising another AI system. Wow, that's very, very innovative, Dr. Spiegel. Dr. Spiegel, you talked about some of these risks and consequences. Are there unintended risks or consequences that our audience should be aware of when implementing AI in healthcare?
Oh, for sure, of course. And this brings up a big question about what is the role of the human clinician, the doctor, in a world where AI is faster, smarter in certain ways at making diagnoses, at prescribing the right treatment course. What could possibly go wrong, right? Well, of course, lots of things can go wrong, not the least of which is the computer could be wrong, as it often is. You know, the computer can't yet look people in the eye and understand their human biopsychosocial illness experiences. I say yet because I'm not saying that's not possible. In fact, we're working on systems that can try to do some of that. But until we have such systems and they've been extensively validated, we're not there yet. So what I think of AI as, like many others, is augmented intelligence, right? Not so much artificial intelligence. It's augmenting the ability of the human doctors to do their job. Now, the other thing, of course, is we're talking right now about cognitive tasks, but what about physical tasks in the three-dimensional world? Surgeries and procedures. I do procedures. I'm a gastroenterologist. We do not have an AI system yet that can literally do that procedure. We do have AI systems that I've used that can help during the procedure, help us by a polyp, for example. And there's another example we could talk about where I'll do a procedure and then an AI is drawing boxes around polyps so I can see them faster. However, in my experience, sometimes it draws a box around something that does not look like a polyp to me, kind of false positive, or will miss a polyp that I see, a false negative. But sometimes it will draw a box around a polyp that I might have missed potentially. So this is an example of an ongoing where we are in this sort of adoption curve. We're moving up the slope of enlightenment. I don't think we're all the way up to the plateau of productivity yet.
Looking to make the most out of AI advancements and innovation? Visit regulatingai.org to learn more about how best to optimize the use and integration of AI and sign up for the Regulating AI newsletter to keep up to date with the latest in AI governance and regulation.
We've had guests in health policy also, and they talked about the generational divide in the physicians. Do you think how we are training physicians needs to now maybe be tweaked, given you obviously are leading the charge on the digital devices, but the adoption with probably the newer physicians might be faster. Any thoughts on how we are training our physicians?
Yeah, many thoughts on that. In fact, I'm writing an editorial about that right now. And Cedars-Sinai, my hospital, is part of the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine, and I happen to be an assistant dean. And one of my roles is currently to co-chair our AI working group. One of our goals among many there is to, you know, continue to evaluate what does this mean for medical education. And we've just actually started this group. We're just meeting for the first time this month. So time will tell what conclusions we come to. But there's no question that doctors who use AI will replace doctors who don't. That's just clear to me. I can tell you that I periodically will moderate what we call morning report. Every teaching hospital in the world has a morning report where some case, some mysterious case from the night before is brought to all of the trainees and they work through it together, moderated by, you know, an attending physician. So I'll do that from time to time. And recently I decided to feed the data into ChatGPT-4, of course, all anonymously and, you know, just giving it the information. And the computer made the diagnosis of amyloidosis in about 8 minutes. And it took the combined efforts of about 25 trainees upwards of 40 to 45 minutes to finally arrive at that diagnosis. We need to use AI. It may get to the point where not using AI is negligent. If you're not willing to use AI, you're negligent because you can't possibly know more than the computer can. We do need to train our doctors in what is the role of AI in their practice. What is the evolving role of the doctor in the context of AI? It's not that AI will replace doctors, not anytime soon. But like I say, doctors who use AI will replace those who don't.
That's a great point that like a co-pilot, you said, or a sidekick, doctors who don't use, a great point, who don't use AI will get replaced by doctors who use AI. Dr. Spiegel, you talked earlier, do you think there's a role for either international or interdisciplinary collaborations relating to AI in healthcare?
Sure. I think the better we can standardize across the world our approach to AI in healthcare, the more effective we'll be. At the end of the day, the human is a human. Particularly, we're talking biologically, physiologically. Now, no two people are the same, but the cardiovascular biology of Iranians is the same, okay, as the cardiovascular biology of Koreans. And what I'm trying to say is this is something that cuts across humanity. And so while, you know, something like defense and how countries manage AI for defense is going to probably vary quite a bit from country to country, we should not be thinking that way in healthcare. We should be thinking about a unified approach to improving the health of civilization through interdisciplinary, multinational, collaborative efforts to develop and codify best practice guidance for the use of AI in healthcare. And I think this is the sort of thing World Health Organization is really well set up to do. I have been fortunate to have been an advisor for the WHO last year in a scoping project where they're looking to the future of digital health. And of course, AI is part of that. And so I think we'll be hopefully seeing more from those types of bodies to help guide an international approach to the use of AI in healthcare.
So what you're saying is obviously international collaborations and organizations like the World Health Organizations are very critical. And Dr. Spiegel, you did mention you're not a regulator, et cetera, but keep in mind we have AI legislation that is being formed. What concerns you about AI from your very important perch? If you were to pick some one or two or three key areas.
Yeah, I mean, I think
because regulators are listening to you right now.
Yeah. Well, I think we've touched on some of them. Are it, you know, implicit bias, access to care, inequity of care? There's a very famous book, Weapons of Mass Destruction by Neil, that lays out really the fundamental concerns around big data analytics and AI in exacerbating those problems. So yes, as somebody with a background in public health, that certainly concerns me. I think I do see some concerning trends in just our recent doctors. And I can't yet tell how concerned I am, but I'm 51. I was raised without the internet. I'm just on the other side of the digital divide. And my colleagues of my sort of era, we studied by reading books and memorizing things and learning things from the ground up. Every step of the way, every page of my textbook, I had practically memorized in my head to this day. I can still see pages from my textbook. Now, when I talk to some of our trainees, it's pretty clear to me that many haven't read a textbook, may never have read a textbook. It's not that they haven't read anything. They're just as smart, if not smarter than we were, but they rely very heavily on the computer to make diagnoses. Quickly go to the computer. And whereas if I kept people away from those resources and quizzed them, there would be a huge decrement in the amount of knowledge compared to what we were expected to carry around in our heads. Now, I don't yet know if that's a good or bad thing. I don't want to be so naive or old-fangled as to say, well, the way we did it was better. But at the time, when you're making decisions in real time, and sometimes we make hundreds, easily hundreds of decisions a day in medicine. When we're on the wards, it might even be thousands. I can't run an AI program for every single decision I'm going to make. There's so many, every prescription and every dosage and every, you know, diagnostic test and every... We can't do that all remote control. You still need somebody who's a rational, coherent thinker who understands humans and their biology and is augmented for the tough calls with AI, but the day-to-day, second-to-second calls, running a code in a hospital, it's going to be a long time before AI systems are doing all of that for us. So it does concern me a bit that I'm seeing less and less of the traditional knowledge in our young doctors than we used to have.
So the foundational, it's like people forgot to actually count and do math in their head when the calculators came in. Now you're saying it. And this is obviously life and death situation. So that's a great point. But you don't know yet whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. That you're not completely sure about that. Dr. Spiegel?
That's right. Of course, if we could spend less time memorizing the Krebs cycle, okay, or so, like Collins did. Thing I never use. You know, maybe we could spend more time thinking about how to optimize diagnostic testing with AI, right? So it's not an all or none argument whatsoever, but I still feel when you're in the thick of things, when you're in the trenches, when you're making critical decisions, and sometimes in the hospital, like I say, this is minute to minute, second to second decisions, you can't just keep turning around and looking at the screen and saying, what does AI say to do? That's just not reasonable.
Not possible.
Yeah.
Dr. Spiegel, being cognizant of your time, final question for you. We have members of Congress who come from rural areas. We have members of Congress who come from inner cities, et cetera. One of the things their hope and they want to know from an expert like you is there is a serious shortage of actual physicians who want to go and practice in some of these areas. Is AI going to be able to help fix some of those issues? That's what some of the questions that came to us.
I do believe that's the case. We have a study right now that we're doing in exclusively rural populations. It's a study supported by the NIH looking at use of, in this case, digital mental health support tools in rural Alabama, rural Louisiana, and rural California. It's a partnership between Cedars-Sinai, UAB, Birmingham, and Ochsner Health in New Orleans. And we're, in this case, managing people with chronic pain using two different forms of digital health support. And one happens to be a form of virtual reality that's FDA cleared, and the other is more of an app, two-dimensional app. And so this is a study to learn more about what works, but also to understand willingness of individuals in those populations to engage in such research, to use technologies like this. So we're very excited. We're just actually finishing that study right now. It's been a 3-year, 4-year study. But to the bigger point of the question is, yes, there are huge deficits in resources in many small communities around the country, where in many cases, for example, there are very few mental health professionals. So that's just been a theme of my comments today. Mental health is overlooked. There is an absolute mental health crisis in the world. COVID only made that worse. Social media made that worse. Many things have made it worse. And in fact, there's such deficits that some people don't even understand that there's something you can do about mental health. There's literally evidence that talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy are more effective than most medications you could ever take. But that means you need access to people like that. And so this is where maybe AI can step in. We've been working on AI systems, as of others, for mental health support. And to be able to provide that for people who don't otherwise have access to humans, we don't want to replace human doctors with AI or therapists with AI, but some people literally have no access, or they may have access, but they don't have money, they don't have insurance, or there's a stigma tied to it. Who knows? So yes, there's many different reasons why AI should be very carefully evaluated as a technique to help equalize the access to at least some form of care in communities that don't otherwise have that access.
Well, that is very, very helpful to know. As you said, talk therapy, cognitive therapy, especially in mental health where the resources are not there and maybe there's more opportunities that comes by. And our listeners, especially members of Congress and rural communities, will be glad to know. Dr. Spiegel, thank you so much. Knowing those thousands of decisions you need to make, we've kept you away from there. This has been very, very helpful. I learned a lot, and we hope to get you on our show again. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI, Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.